Welcome to Idle Chatter, brought to you by the Machinery Digest, where steel and soil meet. A weekly podcast by a New Jersey farmer to all farmers and ranchers across this great nation. And yes, there are farms in New Jersey. Regardless of the crop you grow or the livestock you raise, we all have one thing in common. Agriculture runs on passion, sweat, tears, and machinery. And that is why the Machinery Digest exists. A no-nonsense, grease-under-your-fingernails educational website. It was created to provide a transfer of knowledge so that you can maintain, service, and most importantly, understand today's complex farm equipment. My name is Ray Bohax, and I farm too. It is time now to get under the sheet metal. Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of Idle Chatter from the Farm Machinery Digest. I'm Ray Bohax, your humble host, coming to you from Cat Swamp Road in Warren County, New Jersey. It is a rainy day again today, but autumn has finally come, and it's quite chilly. It's around 41, 42 degrees the last time I looked at the thermometer. And I looked at the rain gauge before I came to record this podcast, and I wanted to give you an update. So far, since January 1st, we have received 52.7 inches of rain on our farm. And I know that there's lots of places in the country of people farm and ranch that are listening to this podcast, and that's, for many of them, that's sadly 2 years' worth of moisture. But you know what's really interesting is that even though we had this amount of rain, you know, it often doesn't come when you want it to come. And as an aside, the normal amount of rainfall for Warren County for our farmers is around 48, 49 inches for the year. So we're about 4 inches above normal so far. And today is November 6th, Election Day. So hopefully that everyone voted or plans on voting. I'm going to go vote right after I record this podcast. So, and hopefully the lines are big, long, whereas means that a lot of people are voting. But anyway, you know, this past crop year, as I've said before in this podcast, like so many places in the country, that the we had so much stress on our sweet corn when we were during the growing season, because we had a damp spring. And then once the corn came up, we had a very hot and dry weather for almost a month, and then the rain came. So it's been all over the map. And but at this particular point, we're at 52.7 inches, and we may eclipse 60 by January 1st, but who knows. But listen, I wanted to also tell you that the latest issue, the November issue of Ag Now magazine, which is part of the Farm and Rural Ag Network, which is a great network that hosts podcasts and vlogs, which is something new to me. I guess it's a video blog. They have their magazine and Ag Now, and the November issue is out. And I ask you to all go and check it out. It's a wonderful publication, and it's probably one of the best, or if not the best, online agricultural resources as far as magazine is concerned. It's a flip page magazine, which is really neat. And specifically, if you go to page 13, there's an excellent article about whether to till or no-till, but I shouldn't say it's on page 13. The picture I'm referencing is on page 13, and there's a root pit dug on this farm, and there's a field day there, and the people are all looking in the root pit, and there's someone in the root pit talking, and if you look down to the bottom, that there's a hen standing there and looking down into the root pit and listening with everybody else. So I'm sure it's her farm, and she wanted to know what was going on, and I have a hen that is like that. And she's a, Rhode Island Red, I forgot what they call her. But anyway, she looks just like that one, and I call her the inspector, because she has to look at everything. I can't get, nothing gets past her. Nothing gets past her. It looks like this, like she has a cousin over in Michigan. So check that out in the Ag Now magazine. And also, on page 24 of that issue, the November issue of Ag Now, you just do a Google search for Ag Now, and it'll bring you right to the digital flip page magazine, is that they have my toolbox testers in there. So every month, God willing, moving forward, there will be a toolbox test. And I know from our analytics that there's a lot of people clicking on and going to the toolbox test on my website, farmmachinerydigest.com, but they are not submitting their results. So I'm really excited about the Ag Now publication putting my toolbox test in, because you were able to take the test without submitting the results and get the answers there. So that's quite good. And as I said before, don't be afraid to take the test and submit the results. And that's when you get the proper answers back. But in the Ag Now publication, you'll get the proper answers by turning to a different page. I forgot what page it's on. So check that out. And, you know, my thing is, if you have not gleaned this by now, that my sincere desire is to help prosper American agriculture. And I've said this before many times, but I just feel it's necessary for me to say it again, is that, you know, success on the farm or ranch is a three-legged stool. It's your agronomy or animal husbandry decisions, it's your marketing plan, and also what you do with your machinery and what the machinery costs are on the farm. And I cannot help you with the first two, but I could certainly help you with the last one, the machinery side of it. And, you know, this test, I make the test up simply because I want it to be a learning tool like anything else, like everything else that I have. It's not to embarrass you, so if you don't want to send that in, that's fine. Just look at the test in the Ag Now publication. But it's meant for you to learn. Because the real test in life is what happens day to day on your farm or ranch, not what happens on a piece of paper or on a computer screen. So I really just want you to be able to learn, and that is why that test is there. Because you have to remember in life, you know, people think that a test when you're in school or what have you is to prove to the teacher what you know or don't know. And that is true to a certain extent, if you want to graduate and go to the next grade level or get a diploma. But it's really meant, the test is to test so that you could learn and you could see what you don't know or what you're lacking. And that is why I created that test the way I did. And, you know, and scripturally, the Bible tells us that God tests us. God doesn't need to. He knows what we're going to get right or wrong. It's that God tests us to prove our faith or what we need to correct to ourselves, not to Him. So please look at that test, and in the Ag Now magazine, take it and use it as a learning tool. You know, on that same theme, before I get into today's message, which is about antifreeze, about coolant, wanted to get into that. We're getting into the cooler weather, is that, and I think there's a lot of confusion, not I think, I know that there's a lot of confusion today about coolant. And as a matter of fact, on November 1st, the new season of the Successful Farming Show on RFD-TV aired, and I have a segment on there about coolant. So if you want to choose to look that up, you could look it up on agriculture.com's website, or I believe on RFD or a number of other places. But I only have 3 minutes and 20 seconds on the TV show to talk about coolant, and on my podcast I have a lot more time. So I want to give you what every farmer needs to know about coolant today. And I think that you'll find it interesting and enlightening. It's not going to be a chemistry lesson. It's going to be practical. Everything that I try to do is I want it to have a practical application for the farmer or rancher. You know, but to get back to the testing and the whole premise of, you know, what I'm trying to do here, and, you know, please, this is not about me. It's about you. It's about the American farmer and rancher. Is that one of my favorite movies is October Sky. And if you've never seen that, you should really watch it. And it's a true story about Homer Hickman. And he's a young boy who grew up in coal mining country of West Virginia and became enamored with rockets and space travel from the Sputnik spaceship that went up in the early 60s. And that was the impetus for him to build rockets and as a as a boy and get involved with understanding things in rocketry and science and mathematics, and his father was against that. It was a small town, and he felt that his son's fate was to be in this coal mine, and, you know, there's nothing wrong with that, obviously. But this boy had dreams, and he applied it, and just a great, great movie. But it's the reason why I'm telling you about it, it's that it's an inspirational movie. And probably during that era, and since it's a true story, during that era in the 1960s, that part of West Virginia was probably, if not the poorest part of our great land, our country, but were one of the poorest areas. And because he had drive, Homer Hickman had drive, determination, and passion for what he wanted to do, is that he was able to succeed. And it's important, it's a tearjerker, so, you know, keep the tissue box nearby. I'm not afraid to tell you that. You know, real men do cry, and but you need to watch all the way to the end, because you need to see what they made of their lives. And I think that it's really important, because so many times you may have a younger person in your own family or in town or in church, and they feel that they live in a remote rural area and that they don't have much opportunity and they don't have much chance to do different things in life. And naturally, you know, I'm hoping that they choose to stay on the farm. But going away from the farm and getting an education and bringing that back is certainly a wonderful plan. And if they choose not to come back to the farm and live their life elsewhere, they would become a very productive part of society. And that's really what counts. So, you know, everybody can live on a farm. If they did, it would be a city. So I'm grateful for the people who choose to live in the city, because, or the suburbs, because then everybody in the farm would no longer be the farm if there were 100 million people living on it. So check out October Sky if you've never watched it. It's a great inspirational movie, and it's, I think that every high school should show it as part of their curriculum during the year. But all right, so that's basically that, and I want to start to talk about antifreeze coolant. And throughout this podcast, I'm going to use the term antifreeze and coolant interchangeably, but really we're going to be talking about the proper name within the industry is coolant. The slang or the colloquial is antifreeze, so it's actually coolant that does not freeze. So I will take editorial license with this, poetic license, and go back and forth and use those terms interchangeably during this discussion. You know, and there is so much confusion about coolant over the past 10 or 12 years, maybe 15 years, because years ago we had one type of antifreeze coolant. There may have been different brands, but we had an ethylene glycol EG based coolant, and we mixed it 50-50 with water, and it was a bright green color, and or close to a bright green color, depending upon the dye that was used. And just keep in mind that that is just a dye. So if you bought Prestone, it may have been one color green. If you bought Xerox, it may have been another color green, or Fleet Guard or something else, but that was just a dye. But it was called traditional green antifreeze. And the purpose of that was twofold. Number one, it was, well, actually threefold, I should say. It was to not allow the engine block to freeze in the cold weather, which was obvious. It was to raise the boiling point of the coolant above what water is. And the third aspect of it was to limit corrosion inside the engine, because water, obviously, and metal and steel, when they interact and have some level of oxygen, they cause corrosion. So that was the purpose of it, and it was alcohol-based. It was an ethylene glycol-based product. And once you get into the chemistries of alcohol, there are many, many, many different ethylene glycols that fall into that family, and we're not going to go there, because I'm really not that well-versed on it, even though I wrote a book on cooling systems, and we don't need to know that. So we knew that traditional antifreeze was green-colored antifreeze, and when you bought different brands, you were basically buying their additive package, but the SAE, Society of Automotive Engineers, had a standard additive package that most products were required to have to get their seal of approval. And then what happened about 10 or 15 years ago, things started to change. And the industry came out with different color antifreezes. And the reason why they are different colors is that they choose, the industry decided to color the antifreeze to determine what identify is the proper term, to identify the chemical composition of that product. So today we have traditional green antifreeze, we have yellow or gold antifreeze, we have red antifreeze, and I believe that there is another, that the orange antifreeze. So we have all different colors. And the industry color-coded the product. They color-coded the product so that you would be able to identify its chemical composition, and then the manufacturer could state, for instance, I have Fords, and my Fords use what is called an orange antifreeze. It actually looks pink when you look at the expansion tank, but they call it orange. It's an orange antifreeze. And then you may have another a car that uses a red antifreeze, which is based upon the GM Dexcool technology. So the thing is that the manufacturer of your equipment, whether it be your car, your pickup truck, your farm equipment, will identify the color of antifreeze that they want you to use. So now this probably begs the question, why did they change this? You know, the funny part about it is the older I get, when I was young, I loved change. I think change was exciting. It was, you know, we were in college and, you know, I studied electrical engineering, so there were not a lot of girls. There was actually no girls. But, you know, if you went to your elective classes like English or history or computers, I forgot what the other electives were, and they think it was, you know, those classes had girls in it. So we used to be all excited, you know, to see what girls were going to be in the class, you know, every new semester. And so I loved change when I was younger. And I think most young people do. They get bored with things as I get older. I just reject change. So I like things to be the way they are. Don't give me change. But anyway, the world changes, right? Everything changes. So as I said, this begs the question, why did the manufacturers change this? And why did they come out with all these different color products to identify different chemical compositions? Well, it has to go back to the engineering. Back years ago, if you looked at engines, and I don't care whether they were gasoline or diesel, they basically all used a green, for the most part, used a green-based antifreeze. If it was a diesel, it had some additional additives in it for cavitation erosion and some other things, but they were basically the same ethylene glycol-based component. And those engines back then were very, very similar in the materials they used. They were usually cast iron blocks, cast iron cylinder heads, and some sort of steel or metal-based head gasket. The gasket materials used for the intake manifold, if it had water going through it, or coolant going through it, or anything else, were predominantly the same. There were some variations, but they were in the same family of materials. And then what has happened is that as the industry moved forward and engine technology moved forward, there was a lot of new materials introduced to the engines. So no longer was the engineer confined to using the materials of the old days. So for instance, Case IH, and I'm just making this up as I go along, Case IH, when they design their engine, let's say for a sprayer or for a combine, they may come and their engineer may say that to achieve the results that I want, I need to use a head gasket with this material in it. And then you may go to Ford Motor Company and they're designing an EcoBoost engine for a pickup truck. And they say, and the engineer says, to achieve the results I want with this turbocharger, this liquid-cooled turbocharger, I need to have this material seal. And then you went to John Deere, and John Deere's engineer said, well, for us to be able to make this passage what we want it to be in the cylinder head, I need a coolant that is going to release very easily and have a viscosity that's going to be able to be pumped through this steam hole in the cylinder head. So what happened was that it was impossible to take the one chemical composition and make everything work. It would have been a compromise. So all of those engineers during their development process would say, man, you know, I really wanted to accomplish this, but the company is forcing me to use traditional green antifreeze, and it's not going to allow me to use the head gasket I want, or make the passage in the cylinder head the way I want, or the seal in the turbocharger, or what have you. So what was realized is that that technology or the advancement in engines was being stymied by being forced to use one type of antifreeze coolant chemical composition. So the reason for all of these different chemical compositions today are so that they are not antagonistic or have any issues with the materials and the design of that engine. Now, any coolant will transfer, or any liquid will transfer heat. But what has to happen is that you have to look at the materials that that coolant is going to come in contact with. And then it can't come in contact with anything that is going to antagonize or attack that part in the engine. So there was different chemical compositions that came about. So now what we want to do is back up for a second. And what I want to back up for a second for is that I need to explain to you how an engine is cooled. And most people have a misunderstanding with how an engine is cooled. They think that the radiator cools the engine. The radiator does not cool the engine. It is the liquid's job to cool the engine, and it is the radiator's job to remove heat from the liquid. And to prove this point is that if anyone has a boat that uses seawater or lake water with fresh water cooling, that there is no radiator in that particular instance. So it is the radiator's job to cool the liquid, and the liquid's job to remove heat from the engine. Now, the hardest part of the engine to cool, be it gasoline or diesel, is the cylinder head, because that is where combustion takes place. So around the combustion chamber, the water passages around the combustion chamber, and specifically the exhaust valve, are the hardest parts to cool, because they are going to have the highest temperature gradient. And within engineering, we use the term thermal excursion, and that's how hot that part gets before it starts to cool back down again. So it's an excursion. It's a trip to a higher temperature, and then after combustion, the temperature starts to lower. So the job of the coolant is to remove heat from the engine. And if you think of a coolant is meant to be like a sponge. Just like if you were to spill something on the counter, you would take a sponge and the sponge would wick it in. So the whole idea is that the coolant needs to wick in the heat from first and foremost the cylinder head, and then obviously from the rest of the engine block, and other ancillary areas, if it was something like a water-cooled turbocharger or what have you. So that is the job of the coolant. Now, the coolant needs to be able to do this, and it also needs to be able to flow through these different parts of the engine. And another aspect of a coolant that people don't recognize, and they only recognize it because they haven't been told about it, but that's going to end right now, is what is called, people confuse viscosity with the coolant's ability to release in the cylinder head. And what's going to happen is that when you are running an engine, and if you're running an engine hard, so let's say that you're pulling a trailer up a long hill, or you're pulling a chisel plow, or you're pulling a real heavy planter, and you're really working that engine, the way the heat is transferred from the cylinder head is through something called nucleate boiling. And the coolant will boil in the cylinder head around the exhaust valve and around the combustion chamber. And that boiling regiment, where it comes from a liquid, gets in contact and boils, and then moves away from the cylinder head, is what, I should say, away from that spot and recondenses is what actually removes the heat. Without that boiling and recondensing scenario, you will not be able to remove the heat from the casting. And the higher the boiling point of the liquid, the better sponge it becomes. The more heat it could absorb before it becomes a vapor. Now, this is not to be confused with boil over, where coolant is spitting out of the radiator. Boil over means that the coolant got so hot that the radiator cannot lower its temperature, and it's going through a phase change from a liquid to a gas, that's to a vapor, and that's why it's boiling and spitting out of the radiator. But when you're driving your car, or you're driving your truck, and you're pulling a hill. Excuse me, when you're pulling a hill and that engine is making power, that coolant actually starts to boil in the cylinder. You don't see that on the temperature gauge. And that is why a lot of larger commercial style engines, big diesels and farm equipment, industrial equipment, actually have a cylinder head temperature gauge so you could watch that, because where you're measuring the liquid temperature for the normal temperature gauge is far away from that site. But the critical aspect of the coolant is that it has to be able to release from that nucleate boiling site in the cylinder head, that it doesn't get stuck there. And people confuse that with viscosity. It's not viscosity. The term is surface tension, or surface friction, you want to say, but it's really surface tension. And it's registered in a metric in a scale called dynes, D-Y-N-E-S, per centimeter. Now, water has a very high surface tension. It is not very easy to release. Ethylene glycols have a much better surface temperature. You could say that they're slipperier. If you put water between your two fingers and move your fingers back and forth, then it's got a certain amount of surface tension, and if you take antifreeze and put it in your fingers, it has less surface tension, so your fingers move easier. It's very imperative that coolant, after it goes through the boiling regimen, the nucleate boiling in the cylinder head when an engine is under load, to be able to release easily and then recondense to a liquid and allow fresh coolant to come there. And that surface tension is part of the specifications of the different color antifreezes, the different color coolants, because you may have a manufacturer that has a water jacket in the cylinder head around the combustion chamber and the exhaust valve, and the engineer says, I want to split this water into a Y because it's a four valve head, and I want half the water to go around these two valves and half of it to go around the other valves. And then to make that passageway, they may say, well, I need a coolant that is going to release very easily, have a very low surface tension. So that is one of the elements. So that is a design, a chemical design of the coolant. And then what basically happens is that the different chemical compositions will not only be able to not be antagonistic to different materials in the engine, but they may have a different surface tension to release. So without getting overcomplicating this, let's make sense of this and what you need to know as a farmer. And I'm going to hit on some bullet points. First and foremost is that don't try to re-engineer what the manufacturer said. If your piece of equipment, if your engine needs a certain color coolant, that's what you have to use. Case closed. I don't care whether you got 20 gallons of green coolant sitting in the corner of the workbench over there. Is that if it's supposed to take a red Adex cool coolant, if it's supposed to take a orange coolant or a yellow coolant or a gold coolant, whatever, just use that. Don't overcomplicate it, because it is just like mixing products in your sprayer. You don't want to have that antagonistic result. And if you have something if you have that antagonistic result and it eats the head gasket or eats the seal of the turbocharger, you hydro-lock this motor, you're talking a $30,000-$40,000 diesel engine in a big piece of farm equipment, or at least a $25,000 diesel engine. And my contention to you is, how many bushels of crop is that because you wanted to save, whatever, $50 on coolant? Okay, So we'll start there. Also is that you cannot mix colors of coolant. And you cannot mix a green with a yellow or with a red or what have you, is that you cannot mix them. Yes, can you physically pour that in? Of course. No one's going to stop you, but you could very easily create a situation that is either going to cause a sludge in the cooling system and or it is going to eat something in that comes in contact with that coolant. So do not do that. Alrighty. The next thing is that I wanted to talk about is that, and this holds true for any engine that's liquid cooled, is that coolant wears out. And if you recall a few minutes ago, I spoke about that heating, that boiling and recondensing cycle of the coolant in the cylinder head. And this goes on. I mean, you could be driving to church with your family in a minivan, and you go to pass somebody, you whack that throttle to the floor, and now that engine's making its full horsepower. Then, you know, horsepower is heat because an engine is a heat engine. So you're putting more heat into that coolant, and that coolant is boiling in that cylinder as it's supposed to be to remove the heat from the casting. But that boiling and cooling, boiling and recondensing is probably the most accurate way for me to say it, actually consumes the additive package in the coolant. And now, what is the additive package? The ethylene glycol, or the propylene glycol, depending upon what type of coolant is, the glycol is what gives the product its ability to not freeze. So it makes it freeze proof. All right. All of the other products or additives that they put into that the coolant manufacturer puts in to it, the additive package is what gives it its anti-corrosion ability, its seal conditioner, a whole bunch of other things. So you're not running, so antifreeze is not straight ethylene glycol. It has a whole bunch of additives in it, and the manufacturer's specific additives are what makes that coolant for that particular engine. So, and I don't care whether it's a 1965 Ford pickup truck that uses green antifreeze or a 2019 John Deere, you know, S670 combine, is that boiling and recondensing that happens in the cylinder head is what actually consumes the additive package. And the most important thing for you to take away from this talk is that you checking the freeze point has nothing to do with the concentration of the additives that are left in that coolant. Now, on a diesel engine, what you would do is you would use coolant test strips. On a smaller gasoline engine, you would not do that. You would actually just change the coolant. And the reason for that being is that the diesel engine in large equipment uses so much coolant that they have what is called SCA. We're all familiar with supplemental coolant additives. So you'd put a test strip in there and say, okay, we need nitrates or what have you, and then you would put this additive package in there. On a smaller engine, it's just more efficient to change the coolant. So keep in mind that the freeze point has nothing to do with the strength of the additive package. And once that additive package becomes depleted, then that is where that engine actually starts to fail. If you have an engine, gasoline or diesel, and it had a head gasket failure, 99% of the head gasket failures, all right, are from depleted coolant. That the additive package was depleted, the coolant looked beautiful, its freeze point was fine, 40 below zero, but the additive package was depleted and it ate the head gasket. So when you have depleted coolant in any engine, you are going to expose the head gasket to an exponential amount of degradation, along with the radiator core, the heater core, and anything else that comes in contact with that coolant. But specifically, the head gasket and the radiator and the heater core are the ones that pay the price first and are the most costly for you to replace. If somebody says to me that I have an engine and that the head gasket is shot, there's 9.9 chances out of 10 that they never change the coolant. and the additive package was depleted, they would go to the service place with a car, or they would, the guy would look, oh, Mrs. Jones, your antifreeze is beautiful. It's down to 34 below zero, and which is basically the chemical freeze point of ethylene glycol in water, 50-50. This 34 below zero. But anyway, and they would think that the guy was so honest that, you know, they love him over these. And Ray's a great mechanic. He's not selling me an antifreeze change. I'm still down to 34 below zero. And no. And the reason why most places don't sell the consumer an antifreeze change is because it's a pain in the neck on today's engines to change the coolant. And it's very it's not profitable for them to spend 2 hours jerking around, draining and refilling a cooling system and bleeding the air out. So they, unless the coolant looks terrible or the freeze point is diminished, and the only way you're going to diminish the freeze point on an alcohol-based product is to add a lot of water to it. But that, so if, and on a diesel engine, once you dissipate those additives, then you're opening that engine up to have cylinder liner cavitation erosion, where the bubbles will actually eat away the cylinder liner and mix the coolant with the oil, and that motor basically is junk. Now, I will put a caveat on that, and the caveat is that if you cook the engine, let's say the thermostat's stuck, then you will obviously have a very good chance of hurting the head gasket. You're not actually hurting the head gasket. You're actually hurting the cylinder head and warping the cylinder head. And then the clamping force on the gasket is not even, and then the gasket blows. So if you cook an engine, be the thermostat stuck and you ran it, or you ran over something or popped a hole in the radiator or blew a hose and you kept running it, then you'll hurt the head gasket. And the other way that you can hurt a head gasket with a turbocharged engine, be it gasoline or diesel, is to overboost it, because then what will happen is that the boost pressure in the cylinder will actually move the cylinder head around, and then once it moves the cylinder head around a little bit and it's under combustion, then you will flame cut the gasket. The combustion flame will actually cut a little canyon or cavern, into the gasket, and eventually the gasket will blow. But if you didn't cook it and you didn't overboost it and it needs a head gasket, it's because you were not good about changing the coolant. Case closed. So that's very, very important. So recap, the coolant becomes consumed by the boiling process in the cylinder head. It uses up the additives. It does not impact the freeze point, but it consumes the additive package. What I'm trying to say. Now, the other thing is that the freeze point is not an indicator of the additives. A test strip will tell you what additives need to be consumed, or not were consumed and need to be replaced. But there's a couple of other things that I want to talk about. Now, you know, so many people buy equipment on at auction, and I'm not saying that I'm against that by no means, but if I was to buy something or if I have my own equipment, what I like to do is do a coolant analysis, and basically any lab or almost any lab that does oil analysis will also do a coolant analysis. And it's very important that you start to do this on your equipment. And specifically, if you're buying something that's pre-owned, right? Politically correct, we don't say used anymore. It's pre-owned, so it sounds better, right? And why should you do a coolant analysis is because the coolant analysis, like a soil test or a tissue test, will reveal what the eye cannot see. And now there is a caveat that obviously the coolant has to be in that engine for some time and have some hours of use to have a valid test. But the good thing is that most people don't change the coolant before they're trying to sell a piece of equipment, especially on a larger piece of equipment, because it's quite costly because of the volume of coolant it takes. They may put a supplemental coolant additive in it, but they don't change the coolant. So if you take a sample and send it to a lab, it's basically going to tell you what is happening with the condition of that coolant and also any degradation from the head gasket or other metals or other materials, I should say, in that coolant. And also is that they'll give you an elemental analysis. And if that analysis comes up and shows a lot of iron in that coolant, then that engine was starting to experience diesel engine cylinder liner cavitation erosion. And even though it didn't pop a hole yet into the cylinder liner, it's starting to really pockmark it and pick at it and make little pinhole dents in that cylinder liner. And that's obviously from the water jacket out to the bore, to the combustion side, and it's starting to pick away at that. So that's very important for you to know. So even though you could go with a hydrometer or a refractometer and check the freeze point, which is good, that's good in-farm shop maintenance procedures to look at that. But keep in mind also that most of those items are calibrated, whether it's a refractometer or a hydrometer, to a liquid temperature about 68 to 70 degrees. So if the coolant is much colder than that or much hotter than that, it's going to skew that reading a little bit. But the most accurate way is to do a coolant analysis. And you should really do this on your own equipment, even if you're not buying a piece of equipment. But, you know, it just confuses me and dumbfounds me that, you know, I watch these auctions, you know, on TV. I watch, you know, Dave Mowitz and Successful Farming go to these auctions, and, you know, a guy's buying a $200,000 tractor, and he didn't pull an oil sample on it, a hydraulic oil sample, engine oil sample, and a coolant sample, and he's bidding $250,000 for it. And, you know, as I said before on this podcast, coming from the machinery world, coming from that, you'd be surprised what people could do to equipment in a couple of hundred hours or 1,000 hours. I mean, they could, forget about it. I mean, that's a podcast unto itself. But also with your own equipment, do a coolant analysis once a year. And do a coolant analysis. And the most important thing for you to think of is that, you know, we're getting into the winter now, and that's why I chose to do this. We're getting into the winter. And, you know, you're worried about freeze protection, and rightfully so. You could check that with a hydrometer, refractometer. But really, you have to be concerned. You know, so many guys will go through harvest, and they'll run the heck out of this combine, and they'll go through harvest, right, or a tractor. Let me use a tractor because, of course, it's used all year round. And they'll go into whether they're doing some tillage in the spring, planting, what have you. They're working this tractor basically all summer, and they have old coolant in it. And then it comes to the winter when the tractor is sitting, and they change the coolant. Because, oh, we got to change the coolant. You really need to change that coolant. You need before it's really going to work, because that boiling cycle in the cylinder head is what's going to consume the additive and totally leave that engine unprotected. It's just like, you know, having a pre-emergence weed killer. I mean, I'm always amazed how in my sweet corn that, you know, 40 days out, well, I shouldn't say 40 days out, you know, when I get near the end of harvesting my sweet corn. So, yeah, it's probably 40 or 50 days. Well, it's 92-day corn, so maybe 60 days, 70 days out. And that sweet corn doesn't have that much canopy. And that pre-emerge starts to wear off, and how those weeds are just ready to pop up. You know what I'm saying? And the same thing happens. So what you need to really do is you need to renew this coolant or put the supplemental coolant additives in before that engine is going to go through its hardest work cycle, because you want that protection there, just like you want that pre-emergence weed killer to be there to keep those weeds at bay so that crop can get established. You know, you working the engine all summer long, all year long, and then going and changing the coolant before you put it to bed for the winter, that's good, because you're you're renewing the anti-corrosion inhibitors. But it was really important to have that when that engine was working. So you need to check your coolant, and you need to be concerned with having fresh coolant or properly additized coolant when that engine is going to be working the hardest. And getting back to that boiling cycle, that is why engines that are run hard, even if they don't spit out any coolant, because the coolant is 50% water and 50% glycol, is that boiling cycle ends up evaporating out some of the water from that 50-50 mix, and that is why the engine will consume coolant. It'll consume coolant when it's worked very hard due to that nucleate boiling regiment, where it's going to boil and recondense, and it gives up some of that water, and that is why that ratio lots of times changes, and that's why when you work an engine hard, that you're going to have to maintain the cooling level because it's going to consume some without leaking. So let's bring closure to this and recap this whole thing. All right, let's make it far more common sense here. The color of the coolant, stick whatever the manufacturer tells you and give it no more thought. It has to do with the chemical composition, how it's going to interact with the parts of that engine, the gaskets, the castings, what have you, and also with surface tension, dynes, D-Y-N-E-S, per centimeter. In case you ever go on Jeopardy and they ask you, you know, about surface tension, you say, Alex, you know, what is dynes per centimeter? Right, so the coolant has to interact with the materials. The coolant actually boils in the cylinder head, and that boiling process, and the more load you have on the engine, the more intense that boiling process is, and that is what removes heat from the casting, the boiling and recondensing, and that is what consumes the additive package. On a large diesel engine that has a lot of coolant in it, you're going to have to add a supplemental coolant additive to it to replenish those additives that are consumed through that boiling regimen, right? On a smaller engine, you would just change the coolant and put new coolant in. It doesn't pay for you to do that because of the volume is so small. Remember, the freeze point is not an indicator at all of how healthy that coolant is. All right, and then the best thing that you need to do is you need to be able to take a coolant sample on that at least once. You could do that once a year and send that out to a laboratory. And, you know, as an aside to this, if you want to trade in a piece of equipment or sell it, I mean, you know how impressive that is to give somebody a book or a notebook with here all the lab tests for the engine oil, for the hydraulic oil, for the coolant? And that is the precursor to telling you what is about to fail or what's starting to go wrong. So you need to do that. And remember, if an engine, gasoline, or diesel ate a head gasket or a radiator core went bad, you didn't pop a hole in it, and or the heater core, there's 9.999 chances out of 100 that it went bad because of you did not change the coolant and it actually ate those components. And, you know, get back to different color coolants. You know, certain radiators have certain solder in them, and if you put the wrong color coolant in, it actually eats away at the solder. So, you know, gets back to the same thing, is that the coolant wears out. Stick with the color that you need to stick with. That the manufacturer says, do not mix them. Do a coolant analysis once a year and forget about it. That's it. And you'll have a cooling system. I have a little Ford Escort, has 450,000 miles on it, has the original radiator, original heater core, original head gasket, original everything, and all I did was use Ford coolant in it and change it every 3 years. And that was basically it. So you know, Try not to be penny wise and dollar foolish. So enough said. But you know, winter is coming. It's a time where you think coolant, and if you renew the coolant now, then you're good for the summer season to spring season when it works, when the engine works. So that's all fine. But understand that the coolant does wear out, and the color may be beautiful. Color is not an indication of the health or the strength of the coolant. It's like a crop. Once you start to see a nutrient deficiency on a crop from 50 miles an hour down the road, you know it's really bad. Once you start to see the color of the coolant really get dark or hazy, then that is really, really bad, and you need to get that out of that engine. And I would also do a coolant analysis at that particular point again, also to see how many parts per million of different materials are in there. So you don't need to be a chemist, you just need to be proactive with the engine coolant. So now we're going to go into our special delivery section. And I am proud to tell you that special delivery is brought to you by Firestone Ag. They are a company founded by Harvey Firestone, a fourth-generation farmer from Columbiana, Ohio. Harvey dreamed of putting rubber tires on farm tractors, and his innovative mindset is the core of Firestone Ag today, and lives on with their 23-degree tread bar and AD2 technology. The soil is the lifeblood of your farm, trusted only to Firestone. So, hey, if you guys get a chance and you're on my website, click on that Firestone tab, and it'll bring you, and they have a lot of great information there about their tires, but about tires in general, and it's just really a good thing to learn, to be an educated consumer. So, I have I'm only going to do one letter today because I'm running along as usual. And this is from Fred in Tennessee. And he writes, "Hello, I hope you do not mind the question about small engines. I have a steel BG55 handheld gas blower that is about 7 years old. It always ran great, and I keep it on the combine during harvest to keep everything clean." That's actually quite a good idea. "But the rest of the year, I use it in the shop, so it runs all 12 months. A few weeks ago, it started bogging when I gave it the throttle, but would idle and start fine. It degraded to where it will only idle, and now it won't even run. I know these small carburetors have problems, but I kept the machine well maintained. I bought another one, but would like to fix this one. Any help would be appreciated, and thanks for the website and podcast. I never knew that I knew so little." Well, thank you, Fred, but I don't think that you know so little. It's just that you know things that I don't know and the next guy doesn't know. But I thank you so much for your letter. And, you know, I have the same handheld blower, BG55, so I'm quite familiar with that machine. Great little blower. I use it all the time, blow off the tractor and what have you, and also around the house. The thing basically with small engines like that, I am going to do a podcast a couple of weeks out about small engines, big problems, is that, you know, people attack the carburetors, and it's possible you have a carburetor problem, but usually what happens with that scenario, and why I think you don't have a carburetor problem, is because it idles and starts well. And I mean, you could have a problem in the high speed circuit, but it idles and starts well. And the thing is that those carburetors on small engines like that, especially handheld equipment, do not have a float ball. They use the gas tank as a float ball. And a very common problem would be that the fuel line that comes from the gas tank to the carburetor gets a crack in it, and it gives you enough fuel to idle the engine, start the engine, runs fine, but when you open the throttle and you put it onto demand, that it starves for fuel. And even though you could have a problem in the high speed circuit of that carburetor, I would say that you either have a vent problem with the cap, that the vent is plugged, and that's very easy to tell by just loosening the cap and trying to start the blower or whatever the small engine is and see if it runs better, or that fuel line is cracked. And it probably just has enough of a crack in it that it's losing the siphon effect, and it could siphon enough to be able to feed this idle circuit and let it start and idle fine. But once you put it under a load, if it bogs like that, then it's going lean, and it's cannot pull enough fuel through that cracked fuel line. So that's usually, on those engines like that, it's usually either a cracked fuel line or a plugged fuel filter in there, or but usually the line cracks, it's a little crack or pinhole in it, and or it's the gas cap. And the third possibility is that there is an issue with the carburetor. But since it ran so fine, and when it started to act up, I may be 100% wrong, and when it started to act up, that it idled and started fine, that I would go for a cracked or a pinhole in the fuel line in the gas tank. So it's not leaking fuel out, or where you could smell it, or it's coming on your hand, that's in the gas tank, and it's getting entrained air into the fuel system, and it's not giving it enough fuel for it to be able to do high RPM and work under load. And another thing that's common with smaller engines, if they have a flame arrestor in the muffler, sometimes they get loaded up with carbon, and they do not, and they'll bog like that also. But I would tend to think that that it's either a cracked fuel line and or a partially plugged flame arrestor in the muffler. And on that particular steel unit, because I have it, is that you could unthread the flame arrestor, and it's basically screwed into the muffler. But I would look at that fuel line first. I would say that it probably has a cracked fuel line. But really the first thing to do is try it with the gas cap off, because that doesn't cost anything. And the next thing, I would look at that fuel line if it's 7 years old and the flame arrestor. But I would probably bet that it is on that it's the fuel line. So listen, I want to thank you so much for listening to my podcast. I hope that you enjoyed learning about coolant. And as always, you know, any questions or comments, or if I can help you with anything, please email me at hotrodfarmer@farmmachinerydigest.com. And then I also want to just tell you that, as always, you know, I'm pulling for you, the American farmer and the American rancher, and this beloved nation of mine cannot be strong without strong, successful, and profitable farms and ranches. So you have a blessed day, and hopefully you'll be able to tune in next time. And don't forget, you could listen to this podcast on the Fran Network, at my website, and also on Ag Daily. You take care and have a blessed week. Bye-bye.